from the Duck South Studios in Morgan City, Mississippi.
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
I want to punch you in the face so bad right now.
This is the On the X podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I didn't get a harumph out of that guy.
Get the governor a harumph.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
Today's episode is brought to you by Advantage Multi from Bayer. Advantage Multi is veterinarians' number one choice in the prevention of heartworms, fleas, roundworms, hookworms, and whipworms. Treats and controls sarcoptic mange. Make sure your dog is protected by using Advantage Multi.
I said what I said and I'll stand by it to the death.
Ladies and gentlemen, can I please have your attention?
And now, here are your hosts, J. Paul Jackson.
You just love to hear yourself talk, don't you? Even when you're not saying anything.
Rocky LaFleur.
Yo, Adrian! Adrian!
Houston Kennedy.
Please, Houston, we have a problem.
And Josh Webb.
Coons! Well, raccoon's trying to get on our back porch. Mama just chased him off with a broom.
Welcome to the On the X podcast. Powered by DuckSouth.com. I'm J. Paul Jackson, and this week I'm joined in the studios in Morgan City, Mississippi by my co-hosts Rocky LaFleur, Josh Webb, and Houston Kennedy. And also this week from the very beginning, we have our very special guest, Jake Latondras of Latondras Media. Now, Jake is a very accomplished videographer, producer, editor, and one of the best duck hunters that I know, as well as an exceptional photographer. So he brings a whole lot of knowledge this week to the podcast. And hey, Jake, Rocky, guys, glad to have all y'all on here today.
Yeah, it's great to be here with everybody. Jake, it's good to have you, man.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. I'm honored to be here, and it's pretty cool to be in this setting with all you guys. You guys are great people.
Sounds like you're having a good time with your kids this Sunday afternoon.
Yeah, and that great people part, it is definitely up for debate, let me tell you. Remember, we do have Rocky LaFleur on the line.
Hey, I'll be honest with you. I was going to ask Jake, because he's out filming so much. Even when it's hot or cold, what do you use for chapstick, man? My lips are chapped.
Hey, man, I'm teasing. It's funny you should say that because I was in Mongolia last year filming, and I ran out of chapstick. I lost my chapstick, and so we went to this little bitty village out in the middle of Western Mongolia, and all they had was strawberry lip gloss. So I had to buy this little container of strawberry lip gloss, and for 2 weeks I ran around with cherry colored lips. So that was pretty funny.
I thought for sure you were gonna say we went to this little village in Mongolia and they had thousands and thousands chapstick, and I thought every time I lose chapstick I don't know where it goes, and it must have went to that Mongolian village.
That's pretty funny.
I didn't think real men actually carried chapstick.
Did you see the book of Eli when he shot that cat at the very beginning? And in that movie it's very resourceful with everything. He ended up, when he cooked that cat, he drained all the oil down into a little container and he used that cat oil as chapstick from that point forward. And he actually ended up trading it for a battery charger in a little pawn shop in that town he went to. You remember that?
I don't, but Jay Paul was about to say something smart aleck about bacon grease and chapstick. I bet that's what's coming out of his mouth.
No. Actually, I was about to say that I didn't think real men use chapstick, but once, Rocky's kids show goats, and I was down at Rocky's last winter, and we were getting ready to go out, and he said, man, my lips are chapped, and he grabbed one of those goats, and he rubbed his thumb across its butt and then across his lips. And I said, good Lord, Rocky, what are you doing? He said, chap lips. I said, chap lips? Does that help heal him? He said, no, brother, but it sure keeps me from licking them. I'm sorry, Rocky. I couldn't resist.
That's pretty good.
So what was you about to say?
11 years ago today, I don't know if you guys, we always remember a
situation and when it happens, we always remember where we were when it was happening. You take September the 11th, we always remember where, you know, where we were when that happened. You know, Katrina was the biggest natural disaster ever in our history. So I ask you guys, where were you when that happened?
What I can remember about Katrina is there was so much rain. It was my first year in college. My neighbor had just planted, what's that? It's a small tree. I can't think of it. Japanese. Somebody help me out here. What's the word?
A bonsai.
Yeah,
bonsai
Japanese
tree.
Magma. Oh.
Bonsai.
Bonsai. And it rained so much. It rained so hard for so long that it uprooted that bonsai tree and killed it. That's what I remember about Katrina.
Were you living somewhere down south then?
Oh, that was in Muscle Shoals.
Oh, okay. Okay.
All the rain that spun off from it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I know we got a lot of rain from that in North Mississippi, but we were, which it took a few weeks to get it all organized, but we went down there, which I was still in high school, and a bunch of my buddies and our dad went down there. And, I mean, it was just chaos. It was absolute chaos. I mean, you just didn't know, you're doing everything you could to help, and even you felt helpless. I mean, even standing there with a chainsaw, you just didn't know which way to turn to get trees off people's houses and out of roadways and everything. It was unbelievable. I'll never, ever forget.
You know, I do not remember where I was during Katrina, but it was like a month later that further west down the coast, Rita slammed into Houston. And that weekend, I was running a hunt test in North Mississippi. And I can remember on that Saturday, I had my wife and my kids with me, which oldest daughter is 22. So, you know, they were like 6, 9, and 11 at that time. And I can remember they had to spend the day pretty much in the truck because it rained torrentially all stinking day long. And I think I was running a dozen dogs that day in that AKC master test. And thinking what the rain was like there in North Mississippi, how really bad it must have been for the people further south and west that were in the direct path of it. And I never forget, you know, thinking, my goodness, you know, we just a month ago got slammed with one in Louisiana, and now they're getting it hit in Texas. How horrible it must be to live down there. And now, you know, this year we've got not hurricanes, but as we talked about a couple of weeks ago, again, unbelievable flooding there in that area.
I remember being in Nashville, and my sister is married to a guy from St. Bernard Parish, which was one of the epicenter of the Katrina disaster, and his family was trying to figure out, this was like 2 days before it was supposed to hit, everyone that was going to evacuate was evacuating. And I remember two things. Her husband's family had 27 people leave St. Bernard Parish, drive up to Nashville, and ultimately move in to their house. So they were packed in there like sardines. And then I also remember John Stevens from RNT. He was driving somewhere up out of there as well, and he was trying to get a hotel room because the storm was about to hit. And I can't remember the exact parameters, but I think he drove like he had to drive all the way up into maybe somewhere way, way north of where he was just to find a vacant hotel room because so many people were driving out of Louisiana trying to get out in front of Katrina. So that's what I recall about the whole situation.
I can remember being in Morgan City when it hit. I can remember being in Morgan City when it hit. And the winds, they clocked some gusts at Greenwood Airport at about 90 miles per hour. So it was still pretty powerful once it got all the way up to here. But I know that this may sound selfish, but I was supposed to have a big dove hunt that following weekend after Katrina hit. It hit on a Sunday night, I believe, and it came through here on a Monday. I had 100-something people coming to dove hunt. With all that happened, I think I ended up having 8 people show up, which was probably good because it seems like Katrina kind of pushed all the the doves out of here after it came through. But I was building the dining hall, which most of you guys, all of y'all have hunted with me at my and been to my lodge. I was building that dining hall next to the lodge at the time when Katrina was coming through. And I remember it pushed rain all through the front of the building as I was putting it together, putting it up. The mosquitoes is what I remember. The mosquitoes that followed Katrina and Rita that year. You brought up Rita, J. Paul. Rita had many, many tornadoes, and a spinoff tornado hit my in-law's house in Belzona, and I watched it. The cool story about the tornado that hit Belzona off of Rita, it picked up a dog kennel with a boy that was guiding for me at the time. It picked up his dog kennel and dog house. The dog was in the dog house. It took that dog about 3/4 of a mile or a mile across a field and just safely set it down. The dog was alive.
Wow, that's
unreal.
Yeah, you know, it's a hunt test that we were at. We were in North Mississippi, and we had a couple of small funnel clouds that got kicked up, and I can remember I was running a water test, water blind and a master, and it started all of a sudden raining so hard that I could not see the dog in the water because of, you know, the rain coming down on the surface of the water. And, man, it was just the weather that we got from Rita kicked up into that area was pretty incredible. You know, I remember thinking, you got to really be hardcore to be out here running dogs. And with that in mind, too, let me remind you guys that this first half of our episode has been brought to you by Hardcore Brands and Hardcore Decoys, makers of the most functional and innovative products for waterfowlers out there. It's not easy being hardcore.
All right, J-Paul, I know you're on your way back from a hunt test right now. And I saw that in the started, you could have someone else shoot the gun for you, but you actually shot the gun yourself. So tell me a little bit about why you do that.
Houston, you came with me to a hunt test a while back where I was running a bunch of started dogs. And yes, it's by choice. Okay, in HRC, according to the rule books and the guidelines, for the started test, the dog does not have to be steady. The handler, to let everybody know what we're talking about, the handler can actually hold the dog and elect to have a gunner shoot for him or her at the line. But at Hunt Test, my wife Melanie and I, we don't do that. We choose to shoot for all of our dogs. And people ask me about that all the time. So here's the reason to answer your question, Houston. We feel like that you're sending a mixed signal. And a whole lot of success in dog training is based around being consistent. So your first introduction for a dog to the Hunt Test world is going to be in the started test. And you go out there, you don't have a training collar on the dog, you've got all the stimuli going, you hold the dog, and when you do that, you're encouraging the dog to pull against you. It's just like when you're teaching a dog to heel. How many times have you seen a person walking their dog on leash, and instead of them walking the dog is actually walking them because they've pulled the leash tight, and the dog doesn't mind that. The dog, you know, they'll pull back against that. Same thing is true when you're sitting at the line with your dog watching the birds go down and you're holding that dog. You're just encouraging that dog to jerk against you. And so from the very beginning, by doing that, you're building a bad habit. So later on, when you move to the next level and seasoned, that dog comes out there, same setting, same stimuli. Now you can't hold the dog, but the dog has already seen that it's okay for it to try to creep, to strain, to go forward, and boom, you've got bad line manners that I feel like you created when you held that dog and started. So we feel like for consistency, you're better off to make the dog be steady from the very beginning, shoot the gun over the dog, and if the dog, you know, breaks, stop it, intervene, send the message from day one in hunt test, hey, you're going to have to be steady here at the hunt test setting. And so, Houston, that's why we elect to shoot the gun for our dogs and make them be steady at the started test.
Jay Paul, I really appreciate your input there. I know we get a lot of dog questions from listeners and Duck South users from all across the board, wanting to know, you know, just a little more on the ins and outs of dog training and why you may or may not do this. And with that in mind, another question that's popped up this week from a Duck South user or member is at their lease where they lease the duck hunt. The farmer practices what today is known as clean farming, meaning there's not as much food or cover left after the crops come out. And so it makes it kind of tough for the guys in that lease sometimes to have, you know, adequate cover to cover guys, or maybe they can put a blind out there, but it kind of sticks out. And so they were kind of wondering on terms of possible food they might be able to plant or cover they might be able to take care of, and also on communicating with the farmer. And I'd like to hear each of you guys' input on that, on how to attack that, especially right now with crops starting to come out, all across the Southeast.
Well, you know, Josh, that is a great question there from that user. And I think that clean farming versus no-till farming has had a huge impact on our success as hunters, both if we hunt on a farm that is disced or clean farm versus one that maybe has been in a no-till program, all the way to, you know, it also has an effect on the migration of the birds also. I get asked a whole lot about my opinion on why we see changing migrational patterns over the last 10 years, and particularly, you know, what I think about the refuges and what I think about birds staging further north. And I think that there are all kinds of theories as to why that's happening, and most of them are wrong. And this is not directly to your guys' question, but we're going to get there. It'll give some good background to this. First of all, you know, I've read that, oh, we're not having ducks migrate to Mississippi and Arkansas and Tennessee, you know, because they feed them on the refuges up north, or because, you know, we're getting such mild winters and it's related to weather. Well, all of that may, you know, it's just people's opinion. First of all, I don't think there's been a whole lot done differently from my research on refuges in the north over the last several years versus historically that's having an impact. It's not weather. I think the biggest impact on the migration and changes in migrational patterns has been changes in farming practices. And here's what I mean by that. And the way that we generate electricity, I want to throw that in there too. Now, let's take farming first, because that was specifically part of the question that we had here. When farmers till, before we had Roundup Ready soybeans and other crops, farmers corn, when farmers till, this is what happens. They come in, they harvest their crop, then they come right back in the cornfield with a great big old disc, and they disc it all up for two reasons. One, they want to go on and start getting that ground ready for planting the next year. Number two, by disking up those corn stalks, they're accelerating decomposition. But they're also turning over the dirt, and so the waste grain that's on top, they're covering it up. Today, with no-till farming practices, it's very different. Farmer comes in, no-tills his corn, he harvests the corn, then he comes back because he needs decomposition to occur, and he takes a bush hog and he bush hogs those stalks all down, and then he lets it set all winter long. Well, when you come in and you bush hog that cornfield that has just been cut, not only are you not turning over the waste grain like you would do if you disc the field, but you are actually broadcasting that waste grain via that bush hog and taking any ears that were not harvested by the combine, and you're spreading that grain everywhere. So with no-till farming, you're leaving a whole lot more food out there for those ducks. And then also with the way that we generate power today, you know, every hydroelectric power plant out there has a cooling pond. So I have seen with my own eyes in late December, early January, 10 inches of snow temperatures in the teens and 20s, and yet in places like Braidwood, Illinois, they still have ducks and geese because the no-till farming has left food out there, and the power plants, cooling ponds are leaving open water, and there's no reason for those ducks to leave. So no-till farming practices have probably had, versus clean farming, it's probably had more of an impact on migration. Now, let's go back to our farmer's question. If you're hunting land that has been disced, you're not going to have as great an opportunity to hold birds because you're not going to have that grain out there like you do if your neighbor no-till farms and, you know, has a whole lot more cover and a whole lot more food source. In order to combat that, you know, there's going to have to be some communication with the farmer. And I know more the impact that it has on migration versus in the South hunting. So I'd like to hear what you guys think about that.
I'm going to answer this as quickly as I can. The two problems that's happened where we sit today in 2016, early maturing crops, because I can remember in the 80s and 90s, people had beans all in the field. They were just left in the field. You didn't have Roundup ready crops 20 years ago. So there were weeds that were left, weed seed everywhere. Well, now, if you look across a field like I'm looking at right now, I'm looking across a cotton field and a corn field, there's not a weed in it. 20 years ago, it was loaded with stuff, loaded with weeds. So it brings me to my point. You have to be intentional about food for ducks. So if you're leasing, if you own your own land, you can be intentional about leaving food for ducks. But in today's age, if you're leasing, you have to go to that farmer. You've got to say, look, if we're paying you so-and-so for a lease, and to have ducks and to have a lot of ducks to shoot at, we've got to have some food out there for them. We can't just disc it, row it back up, and be a bare field and expect ducks to be there. There's nothing for them to feed on. Maybe some invertebrates that may pop up once water warms up a little bit. Maybe so, maybe not. But we all know that's on this call, you have to have a food source if you expect to have and keep ducks. So my recommendation for the Duck South user that sent in that question, sit down with your farmer. Talk to him about it. People understand where you're coming from. They're utilizing the land for one thing. You're utilizing the land for one thing. Work together. Communicate with each other. And I'm sure there's some type of agreement you guys can come to.
Yeah, and I'd have to agree with that. I think that, you know, good communication with your landowner is pivotal to that, because we just took, you know, Rocky, you just said something that is very true, but that is in contrast, and I will make sure that people understand this. So my comment earlier, and I stand by it because I've seen it, I think changes in the way that we generate our power, which result in more open water at these power plants that have cooling ponds that stay open year round, and no-till farming in the north has worked to help that area and to hold birds there. I mean, I've been in southern Illinois there at the big power plant by Marion in the winter and seen the number of Canada geese that used to go further south that stick around because no-till farming means that corn that traditionally would have been disked under is still left out and water is open. On the flip side of that, what Rocky was just pointing out was no-till farming and Roundup Ready beans. You know, because particularly down in the South, the soybean is much more dominant as a crop, or has been until recently. Obviously, corn prices, commodity prices affect this, and we're seeing a little more corn grown now than we have 20 years ago in the South. But still, Roundup Ready soybeans, no-till practices hurt us in the South, too, in that those native grasses that grew up within the bean crop, now they're being eradicated, wiped out thanks to Roundup Ready beans. You're seeing much, much, as far as farming goes, weed-free crops. So that's less food supplies also. And then, as our questioner pointed out, clean farming, those guys that still do disc hey, they're turning it under too. So, you know, it's a double-edged sword. No-till keeps the birds further north, and then no-till with Roundup Ready crops hurts us in not having those native weeds grow in to provide food in the south. Would you agree with that, Rocky?
Oh, I would fully agree. I mean, I think that the way that farming practices have changed over the past 20, 25 years, I think that you've seen the migration of ducks change with it. You see the migration moving further west and north, the main part of the migration staying further north and further west than they used to be. And I think that that has a lot to do with the farming practices. But like I said, let me reiterate it. Sit down, talk with your landowner. I know that there's something that can be worked out as far as leaving some type of food source out there for the ducks, whether it be, look, the thing that a farmer looks at too, as long as you have water on his field, you're controlling the weeds. So use that as a talking point, because whenever there's water over a field, you're controlling weeds by having water on it. So use that as a talking point. But I think it's time to get to Jake.
No doubt. Before we do, though, let me remind everybody that the On the X podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com, is brought to you by Bayer Animal Healthcare, makers of Advantage Multi, the only heartworm preventive proven to still be 100% effective. Well, Jake, we've been doing a whole lot of talking, buddy, but you're our guest, and it's great to have you this week on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Jake, I've known you for a while, and I mean, I've been blessed to be able to call you a friend for a long time, as well as a lot of us. But I would like to bring up to everyone listening how your very first, start, or your very first, quote, paid gig as a photographer / videographer start, because I believe it came from following a hiking little expedition you went on. Is that right?
Yeah, actually, I was on I used to be an alpine climber and an ice climber. I used to climb frozen waterfalls, and I'd venture out into altitude and in mountains around the world. And one time I was up in on the Alaska Range, climbing a mountain called Mount Forker, which sits right next to Denali or Mount McKinley. And we were coming back across the glacier and going back to base camp to catch our plane out of there. And I just happened to look up, and there's a notorious mountain that sits amongst the three big mountains in the Alaska Range, Denali, Mount Forker, and Mount Hunter. And the north face of Mount Hunter is called the Moonflower Buttress, and it's a very famous climbing wall. And I was looking up at it, and these clouds sort of split the wall in half, and the sun was cracking through the clouds, and you know, the contrast of colors between the granite and the snow was there. So I just stopped everyone. And, of course, we were all linked together on a rope on cross-country skis or Nordic skis skiing across the glacier. And I just pulled on the rope and stopped everyone. I was in the back. And I pulled my camera out and snapped a couple shots. And when we got home, got everything developed. Of course, that was back when it was on a color slide film, 35 millimeter. And when I got my slides back, I sent some of the slides out to some different magazines and publications. And this was way before, you know, websites and Facebook and all that. I believe it was 1997 when this occurred. And I never heard back from anyone. And about 6 months later, a friend of mine who was a famous climber at the time, he walked in the town pump, this bar that I worked in, which I now own. Anyhow, he threw the North Face catalog down on the bar, and he goes, "Do you recognize that photo?" And I went, "Oh my gosh, it was one of my shots that I'd sent to the North Face," and it made the cover of the North Face catalog, which at that time was like a coveted cover, like being in National Geographic or something. And so I got upset because no one contacted me, no one sent me any money, no one said thank you, no one patted me on the shoulder or anything. They just put my photo on the cover. So I flipped to the first page, and I saw that they did credit me with it. So I looked through the index, and I found the the phone number to the North Face out in, I believe it was in San Rafael, California. So I called there and I said, I want to speak to the editor, the photo editor right now. So the lady, I forget her name, but the lady answered the phone and she said, is this Jake? And I said, it is. She goes, I know what you're going to say. Just let me tell you, we loved your photo so much. We wanted it on the cover, but you forgot to put a return address or a contact phone number in the envelope. You just sent us these slides, so we figured you'd see it. When you did, you'd call us mad, and then we could settle the score. And they ended up sending me $3,000 in a big cardboard box full of North Face apparel. And, of course, you know, I was an amateur at the time, and it just gave me a tremendous amount of confidence. And North Face opened the door up for me to publish some more photos. And from there, I went on and, you know, published photos with Patagonia and Rock and Ice Climbing Magazine and whatnot, and just sort of took off from there.
That's actually a hilarious story. you know, how that took place. And then, so I guess following that, it was a few years after filming. You had filmed some TV shows, but you got hooked up with Jimbo and the guys at R&T, and you still to this day do some stuff with them. Isn't that right?
I do. In fact, I'm actually even closer now. There was a couple of years there where I sort of took a hiatus, and I started doing more mountainous adventure hunting videos, and a lot of my time was spared. And they went sort of in-house as well with their video production from field to post. And so anyway, recently the last 3 or 4 years, I've really started doing a lot more with them. And, you know, that transition came, I believe it was in 2002, I started with Jay Gregory, and I used that that opportunity on my resume. I called Jimbo one day in 2003, it's back in the summer, and I just asked him to, you know, give me an opportunity. And I gave him, I think it was 2 weeks, I gave him 2 weeks for free. I paid my way down to Stuttgart. He would put me up and feed me. So I slept on his couch in Holly Grove, and his wife, Rosie, fed me chicken tortilla soup every day, which I still love to this day. And just built a relationship with R&T, and you know, they were such a great set of guys and a great tribe to be a part of. And, you know, the friendship stuck. And I guess I could say now that everything that I do with R&T now is really about, you know, my relationship with them and my friendship with them more than it is anything else.
Man, that's pretty cool, too. I mean, want in so bad and to say, hey, I'll come work for free, and if it's usable, you know, do it. And that also, I think, for guys listening out there that want to get into the industry, I mean, you got a lot of guys don't understand that you have to really prove yourself first and pay your dues along the way. And I know before you even started filming for R&T, Jake, some friends and I came out, and you were guiding, actually. Also, you've worked as a waterfowl guide. So not only from behind the camera do you know a lot about it, but, I mean, you were pretty hardcore at it and working as a duck hunter in Nebraska for several years before you started filming, weren't you?
Yeah. You know, I mean, that's a story inside of a story. But, you know, once I found my way from Fort Collins, Colorado, out to Llewellyn, Nebraska, which is where Lake McConaughey is, you know, I came from Tennessee, West Tennessee, where duck hunting was really competitive. And, you know, you had to be fast and you had to be smart and you had to be competitive to compete there and kill ducks. And I found my way out to the Platte River in western Nebraska. And I was sitting in a deer stand one morning on the Platte, not even knowing, you know, it was the first time I'd ever hunted there. And these mallards were just pouring in, all these warm water sloughs around me. And I was just going, oh, my gosh, this is insane. So I went to this little convenience store, and I asked the guy that was sitting at the counter. He's a gravelly old guy, just didn't even really want to talk to anyone. But I got a little bit out of him, and I said, can I hunt ducks here? And he said, yeah, you can hunt wherever you want. I said, anywhere? Like, we're out here? He said, yeah, it's public land. Do what you want. And so I went out and set up in some flooded cottonwood trees, and it was very reminiscent of, you know, any kind of green timber in Arkansas or up in Missouri or on the Illinois River or wherever. And I just couldn't believe it. I mean, I was literally living this dream because I came from this really competitive area. We had to fight for a duck to this place that I had all on my own. And I can remember as a kid thinking, man, I just wish I could have, you know, for one day, just one day, have a place all to myself where I didn't have to worry about, you know, having nine other guys in the blind with me and 10 other blinds around and people shooting swing ducks and trying to compete against your calling sequence and all that. I found myself in this situation where, I mean, it was easy, and it was all mallards. I mean, it was 99% mallards. And so I tried to figure out a way for me to move to that location so that I could make a living there and duck hunt every day of the season. And at that time, too, it was still like a 110-day duck season. So I ended up buying a business on Lake McConaughey and just learned the Platte River and learned how to hunt it and started a guide service. And, of course, that's when you guys came out and hunted with me, and it just sort of took off from there. And then Shannon Nardi, I was on her website. They had Water Dog TV at the time, and I was fascinated by this TV show about retrievers, Labradors, and water dogs. And so I was really proactive with them. And finally, she asked me if they could come out and do a show on Lake McConaughey and the Platte River with me. And they came out and did a show, and I think pretty much that was really the start of something that I really didn't realize was going to happen, which is, you know, where I am today filming TV shows for outdoor television.
Wow, that's a really cool story. And I'll tell you, too, Jake's pretty humble. I mean, he's not going to brag on himself very much, but Jake, you have to be the most all-around cowboy that I've ever met in my life. I've got a photo that I'm going to send to you, Josh, that you can share, or Houston can, on the DuckSouth.com. Not only has he photoed some ice climbing, but I've got a pretty cool photo of Jake scaling a vertical ice wall or glacier. I've hunted with him on the Platte River in some really, really bad conditions. He's a great, great waterfowler. Obviously a tremendous videographer, but one of probably the most or the coolest things that I've seen about Jake, and you may remember this, he was filming with me out in Colorado a few years ago, and it was really, really cold, and my call started sticking. I was really the only one doing much calling, and my call started sticking while the birds were working, and these birds, they were starting to leave, and all of a sudden I heard just mack, 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 mack. Man, it sounded great. And I looked over, and Jake had his calls with him while he was filming. He had actually dug down in his bag, grabbed his calls, and started blowing on his R&T and turned the birds back around where he could film them while we shot them. And I thought, wow, that guy is totally amazing. He can do anything.
You know, let me jump in and say that I met Jake because of J-Paul. J-Paul was nice enough to fulfill a dream of mine about 2 or 3 years ago of I've always wanted to kill ducks out west. And J-Paul invited me to go as a guest and go hunting out west with him, and that's the first time that I ran into Jake. And the thing that I remember about meeting Jake was used to Western life. And what I mean by that was, in the wintertime out there, it snows. Here, if it snows an inch, people just stay locked in their house, and we don't go anywhere. Out there, an inch, 2 inches, up to 6 inches, y'all don't care. We're coming back from hunting on the Green River back to Salt Lake City, and Jake is driving the truck. And I'm sitting in the front seat with Jake, and we're going down the highway, and look, it is 6,000 feet fall offs to our side, and Jake is driving like 60 or 70 miles an hour. It's snowing its butt off, snow all in the road, and I'm like, Jake, slow down, please, you're going to kill us. He said, oh, man, this is nothing. Do you remember that, Jake?
I do. I remember thinking, man, I am so glad that we've got somebody that lives out here in this crap with us right now. But God,
he was freaking me out.
Him.
Yeah, he was. I mean, he was freaking me out. I mean, he's driving through this stuff like it's nothing.
I remember specifically when all that was going on, and I remember. I mean, I've been here for 26 years now. Of course, I'm still a Southern boy at heart. And, I mean, my blood runs orange, and if I have a beer or two in me, my Southern accent really comes out. But, you know, it took me probably 22 years to learn how to drive in. And I remember specifically that one time when, when we were driving, there's always a dry side. When you usually in heavy snow, there's three tracks in a two lane on an interstate, because everyone likes to either drive on top of each other's tracks or right outside of it. And there's always one dry track. So if you keep one side of your vehicle on the dry side, you're never going to slip because you've always got that traction going. And I remember you saying something about that, Rocky, but I remember seeing the road going, we're good, man. This is dry. There's no way anything can happen to us because we had that dry track in the road.
All right, well, Jake, I've got a final question for you. Look, I heard through the grapevine that you have some type of surprise that may be coming out in the next couple of weeks. Can you talk a little bit about that today? Is there anything that you could release about that?
Well, I don't want to let the cat all the way out of the bag, but what I can tell you is that we do have a documentary series coming out, and ironically, we started this concept a while back, but there's been, ironically, and you know, within our industry and our culture, there's been a lot of controversy and politics going on, and my documentary series is going to be different. It's going to be different than anything anyone's seen before in our industry. And I'm trying to get away from, you know, just the hunting aspects of things. And I really want to touch on, you know, what happens or what goes on, you know, on the other side of things. So, you know, again, without getting into too much detail, we're just about done with the first episode, and we're going to start the second episode very soon. And without letting too much information out there, I'm just going to say that, you know, it has a lot to do with seeing another side of things.
Okay, you've given us just enough to tease us now and have all of us going, what the heck is he talking about? And that's all you're going to give us?
That's all I'm going to give you. You're just going to have to see it. You're going to have to see it, then you're going to have to believe it.
So listen, pretty much, and I know this sounds like a huge Jake LaTondres bromance by all of us guys, but honestly, man, pretty much everything that I've ever seen you touch or that you do has been unique and good and done right. Just going to trust you on that one. Look forward to seeing it. And, man, it has been wonderful to have you as our guest. And right now I'm going to, you know, before we close, I want to tell everybody that this part of our broadcast, our guest today, has been brought to us by the Town Pump. Now, the Town Pump is a little tavern in Fort Collins, Colorado, and it has the distinction of being the oldest bar in Fort Collins. In addition to being a videographer, a duck hunter, a photographer, a documenter, Jake LaTondres also happens to be the owner of the Town Pump. So he's also a bar owner. If you happen to be out in Colorado, Denver, Fort Collins, in that area, you've got to go check out this really cool, eclectic little place in Fort Collins. And Jake, my last question for you before I get everybody else's final thoughts is, what do you think, what is the most interesting thing about your establishment, the Town Pump, that you can share with us?
Oh, man, there's a lot of really cool things. I mean, it's 107 years old, so there's a lot of history. There's a bullet hole in the ceiling, and, you know, if the walls could talk, there's no telling what you'd hear about it. But I would say that, you know, one of our biggest claims to fame is the fact that we sold the very first fat tire ever sold in the world. And that may not mean a lot to a lot of people, but out here, and I know that it's become very popular on, you know, on the East Coast and in the South. Fat Tire and New Belgium Brewing Company is one of the largest craft brewing breweries in the country. And to know that we served the very first one and we were their guinea pig to see if this project that they started in a basement of a house was going to work, and to see what it has turned into is probably one of the biggest waves that we ride and one of the proudest things that, that, you know, we've accomplished at the town pump.
Wow, that's a pretty cool fact, and that is exactly what I was looking for. I was kind of wondering, you know, I knew it was the smallest and the oldest, but that's pretty cool too. Okay, guys, well, man, Jake, we appreciate having you. We've got to wrap it up here, but before we do, we all take one last question or final thought here. Houston, Josh, Rocky, in that order. First off, Houston Kennedy, final question, final thought.
Hey, Jake, thanks again for taking time out of your Sunday this afternoon, but got to ask the famous question, what do you carry around in your blind bag? And since you film when it's hot and it's cold, give me your cold snack and your hot snack.
It's whatever convenience store we stop at before we hit the boat ramp, whatever I can find, but I always have either a Red Bull or a Monster in my pack, and then usually a couple packs of crackers and I don't know, man, probably a sausage and biscuit, sausage, egg, and biscuit if I can find one.
Awesome. Thanks again for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, Fat Boy, now you know what's next in there. Josh Webb, final thought, final question.
Yeah, Jake, it's been great having you. Like I said, I've been lucky enough to hunt with you, and I look forward to spending more time with you hunting. But one thing that I've always really, really looked up to you in a way is how you always relive at every moment possible the relationship you and your dad had in hunting and in the outdoors. And now as a father, and you're looking at the years coming where you can have your kids in the outdoors and introduce them to those things, what does that mean to you? Kind of that role reverse, or growing into that role, not really reversing, but how you've grown into that role in life.
What a great question. And it's something that I think about every day. My son, my daughter's 4 and my son is 2. And of course, I mean, my daughter is, you know, not leaning towards that direction. I can already tell my son is. And so there's not a day that goes by that I don't think about this photo of me and my dad. I had my, you know, Red Ryder BB gun and he had his A5 Browning, and this is my favorite picture in my entire portfolio. And what I really think about more than anything is my responsibility as an outdoor dad to teach my son and my daughter how to respect the game, how to appreciate the outdoors, and to do it the right way. I mean, and it all comes from the way my dad taught me, the way, you know, your dad taught you. And I feel like more than anything, it's a responsibility. Even though it's something that I want to do, I feel responsible and that you know, it lies in my hands to make sure that my son and my daughter, as they grow up and become adults, that they lead the way like my dad did for me.
Great question, Josh. All right, the illustrious one. Final thoughts, Mr. Rocky LaFleur.
Well, I'm very lucky to call everybody on this broadcast a really good friend, and what a great thing to have Jake here today. Jake and I have gotten to be really, really good friends over the past couple of years. Very, very talented at what he does. I've never seen anybody that can tell a story and make you see it the way Jake does, and the way he's able to grab information out of others. Very talented. We're very lucky to have him. I hope all of you guys that are listening have enjoyed having him. I hope you've enjoyed having him as much as we all enjoy as calling him a friend. And thank you again, Jake.
Thank you. Thank you, Rocky. Thank you, Josh. Thank you, Houston. Thank you, Jay Paul. I love you guys, and I'm honored to be here. Thank you so much.
Man, it was truly our pleasure having you today. Been a great guest. I'll tell you guys, another great podcast. Hope that you've all enjoyed it. If you're out there listening to us, Thanks for tuning in to the On the X podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.